The first case is Althena McIntosh versus the Department of Defense, 2019-2454. Mr. Sheng.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Philip Sheng, and I represent Ms. McIntosh, the petitioner in this matter. Your Honors, I'd like to begin with the Appointments Clause issue because I think that is a threshold issue that the Court must decide before it can reach the merits of Ms. McIntosh's appeal. Now, Your Honors, I don't believe that there is a dispute that there was something wrong. Something was wrong with respect to the manner in which the administrative judge below was appointed.
Well, can we just break it out? You raised in your blue brief the argument that the AJs are principal officers and therefore improperly appointed. Doesn't Arthrex resolve that question against you?
And by Arthrex, Judge,
the Supreme Court's decision in Arthrex.
Respectfully, I disagree. The Supreme Court's Arthrex opinion, in our view.
So you think even after the Supreme Court's decision in Arthrex, the administrative judges are principal officers?
Yes.
Why?
Respectfully, in our view, Arthrex requires that the board have absolute discretion to review AJ decisions.
Where in Arthrex does it say that?
I believe I don't have the pin site for you, Your Honor, but I believe the very last paragraph of the court's opinion, it says something along the lines of that there can be no statutory or statute interfering with the board's ability or the director, in that case, their director's ability to review the APJ's decision.
And what statute limits the full board's review?
In this case, Your Honors, it would
be... They have de novo review, don't they?
Respectfully, I disagree. We cited in our reply brief the agencies, during the course of the rulemaking process, the agency...
No, that's not good enough. The MSPB can do what it wants. I mean, the director of the PTO can set its own system in place. It's constitutional if there's no statutory restrictions. What the agency chooses to do through rulemaking, to me, doesn't seem to make any difference. Is there any statutory restriction on the full board's jurisdiction to review, or authority is probably a better word, to review AJ decisions? I mean, the answer is no, right?
I would say that 5 U.S.C. 7701E places that limit.
What does that say?
Well, it says that an AJ's decision becomes final absent an appeal to the board.
How is that limited? If that doesn't limit the board, I think everybody agrees the board has sua sponte authority to take up an appeal from an AJ. Your clients have the opportunity to appeal it. So if you choose to appeal it, it's not the final decision.
And again, I think that's where we disagree. I refer, and respectfully, I know you, Judge Hughes, I appreciate your view that the regulation, that you're looking for a statute. In our view, the agency...
If it's a regulation that the board has adopted, the board can also waive its own regulations, can it not?
I believe it would have to go through a rulemaking process, and I believe that in this court's Arthrex opinion, held that the agency is bound by its own interpretation of its rules. So if the agency has interpreted 5 U.S.C. 7701E1B, if the agency has interpreted that statute such that it can only reopen a case in unusual or extraordinary circumstances, the agency...
I don't see how any of this makes any difference because the employees that appeal to the board have unilateral authority to appeal an AJ decision, just like a patent owner or, I guess, a dissatisfied petitioner in the PTAB can seek director review. You can always ask for full board review. Isn't that correct? So you can always get review by, and you agree that the board are properly appointed principal officers.
I agree that...
I think you're wasting a lot of time on this argument, frankly. But, you know, if you want to continue, continue. But I do want to get to one point. To the extent there's a question about whether these AJs are inferior officers, am I correct? You didn't raise that to the board or below.
That's true.
And you didn't put in your blue brief.
Well, it's true that we did not raise it, or Ms. McIntosh did not raise it before the AJ.
And true. Not in your blue brief either.
Well, in our blue brief, we took the position that the AJ is an officer.
No. Come on. I mean, you know what I'm asking you. Is there anything in your blue brief that says, even if they're not principal officers, they're still inferior officers, and therefore were improperly appointed? That doesn't show up to your gray brief, right?
I think that's fair.
Okay.
We responded to the government's argument. The government argued that AJs are inferior officers.
Why shouldn't we conclude that you forfeited that argument, particularly because the problem has been solved?
Two reasons. First, Your Honor, is that the government raised that in its opposition brief.
That doesn't matter. The government will often raise protective arguments in case the court wants to hear about them. That doesn't absolve you from raising the issue for the first time in your opening brief. I mean, I can find you half a dozen cases that say that. The fact that the government preemptively and perhaps, you know, as a matter of precaution, raises an argument that the court might be interested in doesn't absolve you of putting it in your blue brief.
Let me raise another point. You're not arguing here that there was no board at the relevant time.
We are arguing. We do argue that. Let me address Judge Hughes had a second point I'd like to address real quick. Another reason, Your Honor, that I feel that we are permitted to bring the inferior officer argument is that we based our position that the AJ is a principal officer based on this court's Arthrex decision, which was subsequently vacated. It was subsequently vacated, and the parties agreed to supplemental briefing on the issue. And so we did raise it directly in our supplemental brief, and I believe we were entitled to do that. Respectfully, I think that's what the supplemental briefing was for. It was specifically to address the issue of whether or not board AJs are principal or inferior officers. Judge Lori, I would like to address your question. We are arguing that, as applied, the lengthy absence of the board as applied to Ms. McIntosh results in an appointments clause violation. We recognize that this court in Rodriguez held that the absence of the board was merely a temporary circumstance. Respectfully, in our view, Rodriguez dealt with the ability to appeal to the board, which was non-existent. I think our argument is different, is slightly different. As I mentioned, Rodriguez focused on the ability to appeal, and this court held at page 1309 of its opinion that a lengthy delay caused by a severe backlog in cases pending before is no different than a lengthy delay caused by a severe backlog in cases pending before the board. So we're not just arguing that Ms. McIntosh didn't have the ability to appeal. I think it's fair to say, Your Honors, that there are at least three factors that are relevant to whether or not an officer is inferior or is an inferior officer or a principal officer. Those are removal authority, supervisory authority, and removal authority. And I think it's fair to say that during the entire time from Ms. McIntosh's termination to when the AJ decision became final, the ability for a presidentially appointed, Senate-confirmed officer to intervene, to sua sponte, to review, to reopen, to overturn Ms. McIntosh's termination was non-existent.
Well, now, let me probe that proposition a bit. Your position is not, I take it, that if there is a vacancy for even a very brief time, that converts the AJs from either employees or inferior officers into principal officers, right? There's a vacancy for a week in the lack of a quorum on the board. Right?
That's correct, Judge Bryson.
Okay, so what I'm struggling with, and had the same problem in Rodriguez, of course, which presented some somewhat similar situation. What is the point at which one decides, well, these vacancies have been there for so long that now the AJs are principal officers? What's the point at which they get kind of imbued with that authority or that status constitutionally? It seems like a strange doctrinal problem to that we would have difficulty in trying to assess where to draw the line.
Thank you, Judge Bryson. I completely agree, and I struggle with the same question. This court's recent Arthrex opinion, the one that recently came out, we submitted a Rule 28J letter on that, did count the number of days, counted 310 days, I believe, in Eaton, and it looked to the number of days. I respectfully think counting the days is not, I think it's a, you know, it's a slippery slope. In our view, you know, Ms. McIntosh, you know, from the day she was terminated until her decision became final, lacked those three things that I mentioned earlier. There was no review authority. There was no supervisory authority. There's no removal authority. The AJ below had no threat of removal. And if we are to count days, Your Honor, the number of days for Ms. McIntosh's case was 1,666 days. That's five times longer than the Supreme Court found held permissible in Eaton, and almost 400 days longer than the Rodriguez case. You know, footnote 12 of the Rodriguez decision, you know, does say that you know, there could be a case in which the lengthy absence of the board could result in an appointments clause violation. And respectfully, this is that case, 1,666 days.
Mm-hmm. What makes 1,600 the right number as opposed to 400 or 1,000 or 1,200? Where do we see in the Constitution any guidance for any of this?
There is none.
To me, it sounds like a seat of the pants argument. You're like, well, I don't know what's enough, but ours is enough. It seems an odd way of doing constitutional interpretation.
Respectfully, I think I'm bound by this court's precedent.
I wonder if it wouldn't be reasonable to say that if there were some sort of structural change, if, for example, the Senate should pass a resolution, I'm just flying here with this hypothetical sort of blind, but if the Senate should pass a resolution saying, we believe that it's not necessary to have a Merit Systems Protection Board as such, the board members. And therefore, henceforth, until otherwise advised, there will be no consideration of a board member. We will not have board members. Then you have something where you might say, well, all right, a vacancy here which is enforced by an unwillingness on the part of the Senate to consider nominees might be enough to make a constitutional change, but simply the delay strikes me as hard to find a constitutional line, as Judge Hughes was saying.
It is difficult, and I appreciate that. And you know, again, I look to Rodriguez, the footnote 12. You know, this is the court saying that, you know, there could be a case in which the delay, if 1,666 days isn't lengthy enough, that footnote, I'm not sure, you know, how far is required. But again, I just go back to the fact that during, you know, when Ms. McIntosh was terminated until her decision became final, you know, there was no, you know, from the lower official to the president, there was no chain, no accountability there. And I recognize I'm
but a little bit time. Decision becoming final was your choice, right? If she had wanted review by a principal officer appointed and confirmed by the Senate, she could have gotten one, right? She would have just had to wait. Like, I assume there are thousands of cases pending at the board right now.
That is true. And we exercised our statutory right to appeal to this court, but, which you said, Judge Hughes, is correct. I'm out of time. I'd like to reserve whatever I have left for rebuttal.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Lurie.
Ms. Fomenkova. My notes here say you're splitting your time with Mr. Fung, whom I don't see at the council table.
He is over there in seat 10.
All right, fine, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. There are two principal issues, broadly speaking, in this appeal. There's the merits questions and the appointments clause questions, and I'm happy to take them in whatever order the court would prefer, but I thought I'd start with the merits instead.
Well, I think your friend spent all of his time on the appointments clause issues, so
I'm happy to talk about those.
Why don't you address, I'm particularly interested in your response to his assertion that the AJs are still principal officers, even after the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision.
So, Your Honor, in our view, the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision definitively demonstrates that they're not principal officers, that they've never been principal officers, and they have no need to be principal officers, and that the statutory structure of the MSPB is, in fact, perfectly constitutional. As the Supreme Court emphasized in Arthrex, the key question is, are the administrative judges making final decisions that are binding on the executive branch without any opportunity for review by a principal officer? And that was restricted. It used to be restricted at the PTAB because you could only petition for review by another panel of administrative judges. That's not the case at the MSPB. 5 U.S.C. 7701E allows currently and has always allowed any petitioner to submit a petition for review to the board, who everyone agrees is comprised entirely of principal officers that have been validly appointed. And that was true even when there was no quorum. When the board was temporarily without a quorum, petitions for final review to the board could still be filed, and that would prevent any decision by the administrative judge from becoming final. I'm not sure exactly what the exact number is, but a number of people, in fact, did file petitions for final review during that absence, and those are being considered by the board now that it's been reconstituted, and Ms. McIntosh could have done the same. So under the statutory structure of the MSPB...
What about his argument that the MSPB's, the full board's review authority is limited? I guess I have two questions. One, is it? And if it is, does that have any constitutional significance?
So it is not. Under the statute, the board has some regulations about the circumstances in which they will reopen a case once it has become final. But before a case becomes final, any party is free to petition for review of the board, and until the board resolves that petition, the decision does not become final. And the circumstances in which the board may take up one of those petitions for final review is not limited to unusual circumstances. It's we cited the regulation in our brief. It's an including but not limited to laundry list of various reasons. And so there is no meaningful statutory or even regulatory limitation on the circumstances in which the board can take up a petition for final review.
Suppose there were a very draconian regulatory limitation on the board's reviewing authority that they self-imposed. Would that, I'm really asking the same question Judge Hughes asked of your opposing counsel, would that have a constitutional consequence under the Appointments Clause?
I think in the first instance, I think that would certainly be something that the board should be raised to the board in the first instance and for them to consider if they want to sort of revise their regulations, because the board.
Okay, let's assume that it was raised and the board said, go away, we're not concerned by this. And it comes to us, and the board has a regulation which says, that we will only, consider cases, a maximum of 5 cases a year. Would that convert the AJs into principal officers?
It would be a hard question, I think, constitutionally, Your Honor, because obviously we don't know which 5 cases are being considered. And certainly under Arthrex, they could take 0 if the board has sort of unfettered discretion to take a case. It doesn't actually have to exercise that authority for any of them. I think it would
what
be
I'm getting at it really is does a an agency's self-imposed restraints on what otherwise would appear to be unrestricted supervisory authority end up having constitutional significance under the Appointments Clause?
I mean, I think I would go back and say because the agency can always change their self-imposed restraints, and I think, in fact, the board has regulations that allow them to waive their existing regulations, that even if they had something sort of that fixed, if a case sort of, if there's no limit on which cases can be submitted for petition for final review, if the board sees a sixth meritorious case that they feel should be reviewed, I see no reason why they couldn't do that if it was in the face of a regulation. You know, obviously the board is bound by a statute. A court is the only one who can rescind a statute, or Congress.
While a regulation is in place, the agency is bound by the regulations. The Supreme Court has said that a number of times. You have to follow your own regulations until you get them changed by process that is spelled out in the APA.
Sure, but I think even in that hypothetical, if we have a regulation that said you can only review five and they wanted to review a sixth, all they would have to do is go through the process of changing the regulation to allow them to do so.
I mean, it sounds to me like the challenge would be to the regulation as inconsistent with, you know, the Appointments Clause, and that we would strike down the regulation and order, you know, the board to hear more cases or exercise its discretion more fully.
I think I would agree with that.
To conclude that the AAJs were somehow transformed into principal officers. I mean, it would be the underlying text, but you would challenge the application of that regulation. If in denying the petition for review, the board said, we've already exceeded our five-case limit, that the regulation would be found to be unconstitutional somehow.
I think that's right, Your Honor. Yes, it wouldn't be that they would become a different kind of officer. It would be that something would happen to the regulation if the regulation was sort of prohibitively not allowing them to exercise that discretion.
I'm sorry, you finish your point.
No, I was just going to say that the statute here, the point is that right now there is no such prohibition. Right now there's no limit to the number of cases or the type of cases that the board can take up and consider. It can, you know, any petitioner can seek review, and the board also has the authority to sua sponte take up a case, even if a petitioner does not seek review. So it's really wide open here.
Addressing the footnote in Rodriguez that Mr. Shang pointed out, do you think that either A, that footnote is wrong, or B, that the period of time hypothesized in that footnote did not come to pass here?
I think my primary response to the idea of sort of what effect the absence of a board has here is that, you know, they never really became principal officers, even when there was no board, because the Senate hadn't yet confirmed one, because you could still file a petition for final review, and that petition would ultimately be considered, that supervision did exist. You know, Mr. Shang talked about
even though there were no supervisors on plan place.
But they would come back. That you would essentially hold the case in abeyance until they returned and exercised that supervisory authority.
Yeah.
So the only reason that her case from her termination all the way to a final decision, there was no board, is because she didn't file for board review and allowed it to become final and terminated that way.
Let me ask the question in a reverse form. Can you identify for me the kind of case as to which you would say, okay, in this case, now, the absence of a board, by virtue of non-approval or non-nomination or whatever, has triggered the Appointments Clause problem?
I struggle with that. I do like your hypothetical where the Senate actually comes out and says we're never going to approve a board. I think that you know, introduces a sort of a structural element that maybe changes the picture. But I think here we were constantly actively in the process of nominating or trying to get a board confirmed. It just took longer than frankly, probably anybody wanted it to. But sort of throughout that time, any petitioner could preserve their right for board review once everybody agrees constitutionally valid board, what was appointed and confirmed as they have been now. I see I'm running out of time, so if there's other questions at the court, I can answer.
Well, we'll hear from Mr. Fong now.
May it please the court. The MSPB agrees first with the Department of Defense on the question of waiver. But to the extent that this court does not agree regarding waiver, the board's restoration of quorum on March 4th means that we're no longer seeking a remand from this court to address the issues in the first instance. Immediately upon being sworn in, the board ratified the appointment of all of its existing administrative judges under the presumption that they likely are inferior officers under the Constitution.
So the real question for us is if we find it waived, we get to the merits here. If we don't find, if we decide not to enforce the waiver, then under the regular precedent, we would send it back for hearing by a new AJ.
Yes, under Lucia, this would just go back to a new administrative judge whose appointment has been ratified by the board for a new hearing. Going back to the principal officers first.
Since you're here, yes. I know you're from the board, and this isn't in the case, and you may not know, but do you have any sense, this is just curiosity, how many petitions for review are pending at the board now?
Last count was approximately a little over 4,000. We do a monthly count. Yes, it's a significant number, I know. And the board, now that they've been restored, are doing their best to work that backlog down. We just added a new member 9 days ago, and so hopefully the three members will do their best to reduce the backlog as expediently as possible, knowing it's a lot of work. So, but yes, it's around 4,000. So the Supreme Court in Arthrex, though, focused on whether there was an individual with the ability, not necessarily a mandatory review, just somebody with the ability to review decisions and alter decisions of administrative patent judges. And there was not the Secretary of Commerce, not the Director of PTO. The board, as my friend already stated, has that unfettered ability all the time by statute to review any decision it wants. Any party can file a petition for review to the board. And the board, at any point after a decision has been issued by the administrative judge, can reopen that decision and review it. There's no time limit on that. 5 years later, the board, if it wanted to, could right now reopen Ms. McIntosh's decision. By regulation, we've expressed our policy preference that we're generally not going to do so, but it doesn't mean that we can't do so. It just means we generally won't do so.
What do you say about the argument Mr. Sheng makes that he should not, or Ms. McIntosh should not be held to a waiver of the inferior officer argument under all the circumstances involving the Arthrex, the second Arthrex decision, et cetera?
I believe that the argument was not initially raised before the board, and it was not raised to this court originally. And so as the Department of Defense has indicated, we think the argument should be considered waived.
Let's assume that we don't agree with you that there was a requirement that it be raised before the board, and focusing just on whether it was waived by not being raised in the blue brief in this case. Can you respond to Mr. Sheng's argument that the sequencing of events, including the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision and the supplemental briefing in this case, are such that there should be deemed to be no waiver?
The original brief put forward by Ms. McIntosh was about the idea that the board, the AJs were principal officers, and then the Supreme Court's granting cert in that case was about whether or not the APJs were principal officers. So in our position, or in our mind, any supplemental briefing was about the Supreme Court addressing the question of whether or not they were principal officers, and the idea of inferior officers wasn't really at issue any longer. It was just about whether or not APJs were principal officers, and therefore whether AJs were principal officers. So we still believe that the issue should be considered waived as well because it wasn't something that was considered in the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision. Going back to your hypothetical briefly, by the way, about the 5 versus 6, I think, well, for one thing, the board, as my friend said, does have the ability to waive any of its regulations at any time. 5 CFR 1201.12 gives the board the authority, or says the board will waive its regulations if it feels necessary. But in the event that does not apply, I think what you'd actually be doing is creating a situation akin to Hellman, in which if that fifth case somehow bound the board, so the board could never review a sixth case, it would recreate the VA statute from Hellman that was found to be unconstitutional, because that did convert the AJs to principal officers. I see my time has expired. This court has any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Mr. Shang has 2 minutes only on the appointments clause, because there's nothing to respond to on the merits.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, I would just encourage the panel to review the Federal Register sites that we cite on page 21 of our reply brief, and that's 77 FR 62350 and 62359. It's crystal clear from the legislative history or the rulemaking history there. During the notice and comment procedure, there were specific comments that, hey, you guys are severely limiting your ability to reopen a case under 7701E. And the agency's response is that, well, that's what we're going to do. In fact, there was a comment that said, your rule is going to severely limit the MSPB's authority to reopen and reconsider cases. And the agency's response was, you know, we must confine ourselves. It says reconsidering a final decision must be confined to rare and limited circumstances. So in our view, that places a significant thumb on the scale. For example, the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision, I can't imagine the Supreme Court saying, okay, we can provide for director-level review, but the director can only review under rare, unusual, limited circumstances and must do so in a short period of time. I don't think the Supreme Court would have found that permissible. And then lastly, Your Honors, just want to emphasize the significant power that AJs have to conduct hearings, to issue subpoenas, conduct discovery, hold petitioners in contempt or whatever the word is before the board. There was no supervisory authority, no review authority, no removal, no threat of removal during that entire time that power was exercised. And that's all I have, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Shang. The case will be taken under submission.